This is day 5 of this October 2016 7-day session. We'll return to our text from earlier, a book called Zen Dawn, which is a collection of earliest Zen texts. And these are from the Dunhuang Caves in China. These are translated by J.C. Cleary. We're in the chapter about the fourth ancestor, Dai Dao Shun. Question: how can we understand the characteristics of the Dharma? How can we illuminate and purify our minds? Dao Shun said, not by reciting the Buddha name, not by restricting mind, not by observing mind, not by calculating thought, not by contemplation, not by the practice of observation, not by scattering and confusion. Just let it roll along. Don't make it go. Don't let it stay. Just let it roll along. Non-abiding is the word that has been used since the very beginning of the Zen school. Let the mind flow without trying to block it, stop it. These other practices, he says, not by reciting the Buddha name. That's another school. It's the Pure Land school. Not by reciting the Buddha name. Not by restricting mind. Not by observing mind, that implies a subject as opposed to an object. Not by calculating thought. Some of these I don't know. I'm not familiar with them as practices. Not by contemplation. Elsewhere he uses contemplation as part of his teaching. Not by the practice of observation, same as the observing mind, the subject-object split. Not by scattering confusion. There is this very small difference between Zen meditation and Vipassana meditation. In Vipassana meditation, you're invited, when a thought comes into the mind, you're invited to just watch it until it goes away by itself. Whereas in Zen, we say, as soon as you notice a thought, redirect your attention, get your attention back to the practice you're working on. I've attended a couple of talks by leading Vipassana teachers in my Zen career, and as nearly as I can tell, that's about it. It's the main difference. In one, in Zen, you swing your attention back to the practice, and in Vipassana. There are probably different kinds of Vipassana meditation, but the kind that these teachers were talking about, you continue observing the thought until it passes by itself. here, Daoxin, that's one of the, in this list of things not to do, not by the practice of observation, and certainly not by scattering and confusion. Just let it roll along. Don't reject it. That's the traditional terms. Don't reject it. Don't cling to it. In the solitary purity, the ultimate locus, mind of itself is illuminated and pure. The ultimate locus. If we can observe it truly, mind is instantly illuminated and pure. Mind is like a clear mirror. If we can observe it truly for a year, here too, there's always the danger when you have a translation of the words that the translator chooses. Observe, I wouldn't use that word in Zen. If we can be one with it truly for a year, it will be even more clear and pure. If for 3 years or 5 years, even more clear and pure. Some can find understanding by hearing people explain for them. Some never need explanations to understand. A sutra says, the real identity of the mind of sentient beings is like a precious pearl submerged in water. When the water is turbid, the pearl is hidden. When the water is clear, the pearl is revealed. There's a passage I came across this morning by a Daiyo Kokushi, a Japanese national teacher, national Zen teacher from, I don't know, the Middle Ages. And here he is talking about this mind of this mind that is common to the enlightened and the unenlightened alike. There is a reality even prior to heaven and earth. Indeed, it has no form, much less a name. Eyes fail to see it. It has no voice for ears to detect. To call it mind or Buddha violates its nature, for it then becomes like a visionary flower in the air. It is not mind, not Buddha. Absolutely quiet and yet illuminating in a mysterious way. It allows itself to be perceived only by the clear-eyed. It is Dharma truly beyond form and sound. It is Tao, having nothing to do with words. Wishing to entice the blind, the Buddha has playfully let words escape his golden mouth. Heaven and earth are ever since filled with entangling briars. Oh, my good, worthy friends gathered here, if you desire to listen to the thunderous voice of the Dharma, exhaust your words, empty your thoughts, for then you may come to recognize this one essence. And now he, back to our text where Daoxin is talking about the unenlightened, the ordinary person. Because they slander the three jewels and disrupt the harmony of the Sangha, because they are polluted with opinions and vexations, because they are stained by craving and anger and delusion, sentient beings do not awaken to the fundamental eternal purity of the real identity of mind. Thus, when they practice, they grasp understanding in different degrees. These differences generally come from their differences in capacities and causal conditions. This is commonly see this in Chinese Buddhist texts. This differences in capacities, but it's more one's karmic readiness, and yes, that varies with each individual. But through practice, through steadfast practice, that this mind of enlightenment that we all share is becoming riper and riper. There's one device that one trap one can fall into is sort of resigning oneself to having too many karmic obstructions. I suppose that's not untrue. If one has not reached the point one needs to, then there's some kind of a karmic obstruction, but we never want to let it go at that. Yes, we all have our karmic obstructions, but stop thinking about yourself. That's the obstruction, thinking about your karmic obstructions. Question, in the moment, how should we practice contemplation? Or Zazen. Daoxin said, you must let it roll. There's a passage in the Diamond Sutra, arouse the mind without its abiding anywhere. There's also the simile in one of the koans, I think it's in the Blue Cliff Record, of a gourd, a husk or a shell floating on the water. Skipping a couple paragraphs here, he says, the first stage, bodhisattva, I think he may mean by that a beginner, the first stage, bodhisattva, first witnesses everything as empty, then witnesses everything as not empty. This is non-discriminating wisdom. And this is form. Form is emptiness. It is not emptiness that wipes out form. Form, by nature, is empty. We chant the same thing every day in the Prajnaparamita. Form, by nature, is empty. Form, what does that mean? Well, it means everything, everything we can touch or think about, every word, certainly every idea, is empty. Bodhisattvas cultivate and learn emptiness as their realization. Well, that's what we're doing with any of these Zen practices. When we are dwelling in mu or the breath, we are dwelling beyond form, beyond thought, beyond images. we're becoming acquainted with this emptiness. When new students directly see emptiness, this is just seeing emptiness. It is not real emptiness. I think of the line from Affirming Faith in Mind, to encounter the absolute is not yet enlightenment. Then he says, those who cultivate the way until they find real emptiness do not view things as empty or not empty. They have no views. You must understand properly the meaning of form and emptiness. They do not view things as empty or not empty. In other words, there are no notions, there are no ideas about the nature of things. Ideas just get in the way of true seeing. And then Daoxian warns about false teachers. Just reminds us that this is a perpetual problem. In Zen, as in other traditions, there are people who teach living beings for the sake of fame and profit without comprehending the characteristics of the ultimate Dharma. They do not recognize relative degrees of depth and shallowness in their students' capacities and causal affinities. They give their seal of approval to everyone, to people who seem enlightened but are otherwise. This is most painful. It is a great disaster. Whenever someone seems illuminated and pure in their perception of mind, they immediately give their approval. The key word being seems. People can get into states in which they can have great, bright clarity, but these states pass if it's not true awakening. They immediately give their approval. These people are gravely damaging the teaching of enlightenment. They are deceiving themselves and deceiving others. People who use mind with such divergences and present this appearance have not found mind. He's using the word found here, realized. Not realize mind. Those who truly realize mind recognize it clearly for themselves. He's talking about a more significant opening, a more significant awakening. Dogen says somewhere that one does not necessarily know if he has Kensho. And for sure, most people who pass their first koan do so in a very faint, very shallow way. It can be real enough, but requires a lot of deepening and enlarging. It says, after a long while, the Dharma eye opens by itself and is well able to distinguish what is empty and false. I think here he's using the word empty in the ordinary negative sense. Skipping a couple pages here, he says, no matter whether it is day or night, focus the energy so that it does not move. When the mind is about to run off and scatter, quickly gather it back. It is like tying a bird's foot so that when it wishes to fly away, it is held fast. Well, this would be good advice in Sesshin whenever we leave the Zendo. When the mind is about to run off and scatter, quickly gather it back. Gather it together through awareness of the practice, of course. He says, contemplate without stopping all the time. When purified, mind will stabilize itself. Here, too, is what I was saying yesterday, I think, about maintaining the awareness of the practice continuously, or as continuously as one can. This is, it's so difficult, because we make a strong effort in the Zendo, and then the tendency is to let up when we leave the Zendo. It doesn't mean that we have to exert ourselves outside the Zendo in a way that is contrary to what is natural. We just have to notice what does it mean to keep it continuous. It means then when we're walking down the hall outside the Zendo, let's say on our way to lunch or eating lunch, to just notice when the mind has wandered and bring it back to the practice we're working on. That doesn't have to be some Herculean struggle. It's just noticing and then returning the mind to the practice. I think what makes it so difficult is the habit of when after noticing the mind having wandered, of then launching into a commentary about it. The Vimalakirti Sutra says, gathering in mind is the site of enlightenment. And then Dao Shin says, this is a method for gathering in mind. The root word for concentration is to bring together or to gather together. And he quotes a sutra called the Bequeathed Teaching Sutra. Mind is the ruler of the five faculties. Control it in one place and all will be accomplished. Then he presents a metaphor for the very nitty-gritty of moment-by-moment practice. He says, those who hear should practice. Don't be doubtful and confused. It is like a person learning archery. At first he shoots at large targets. By and by he can hit smaller and smaller ones. Then he can hit a single feather, then hit it and smash it into 100 pieces, then hit one of the hundredths. Then he can shoot the arrow before with the arrow after and hit the notch, so the arrows line up one after another and he does not let any arrows fall. It's a metaphor, okay? It's a metaphor. And then he says, this is a metaphor for practicing the way, concentrating the mind from thought instant to thought instant, going on continuously from mind moment to mind moment without any interruptions, so that correct mindfulness is not broken and appears before you. This is the kind of meticulous attention we need to bring to our work, to the practice. It's looking meticulously, watching as we see the mind begin to stray and then bring it right back. More and more quickly, the lengths of time that we're with the mu or the breath or the koan, but the lengths of time we're with it gradually get longer, and the times when we're not with it get shorter, little by little. It's very exacting work at its best. Another sutra says, with the arrow of wisdom, shoot through the gate of triple liberation. Let the arrows line up and hold each other up so that none fall. So this is an old metaphor that he's bringing us back to. And then he switches to another metaphor. Again, practice is like drilling for fire. If you stop before it gets hot, though you may wish to get fire, it is impossible. Yeah, this is also a good one. The need to persevere. I've never tried to start a fire in that primitive way with a rod and something rubbing the friction, rubbing it. But it's plain to anyone who's ever seen it or heard about it that you can't let up. You have to press on. But then, that once you've crossed that threshold, once you get to that critical point, you've got a fire that can save your life. And then he continues with his arrow theme. He says, again, it is like a poison arrow entering the flesh. The shaft has been pulled out, but the point is still in there. Suffering pain like this, there is no forgetting it, even temporarily. It is constantly in mind. One who is practicing must be like this. There's no substitute for pain. The pain, especially the pain of not knowing. This is the great motivator. When it becomes too painful, when it becomes so painful not to know our true nature, then we will know it. We'll find a way. When it becomes intolerable to go another sesshin without knowing, we'll find a way. And then go on to the next chapter, which is the fifth. I think I may have said the previous one was the fifth, that he was the fourth. The fifth is Hongren. of Yuju Temple on Shuangfeng Mountain in Jizhou, if you were wondering where it was. So this is the fifth patriarch, the fifth ancestor. This was the teacher of the great Huineng, the sixth patriarch, of course. Let's switch to our other text, Zen's Chinese Heritage, and by Annie Ferguson, and read some material there on Hongren. He writes, the fifth ancestor in China, Hongren, was a person from so-and-so. In his previous life, he was a Taoist who planted trees on twin peaks. Remember, these somewhat fantastical accounts, this is just a translation of the records. Andy Ferguson, the translator, found these records, some of them etched into stone, and just presents them for what they say. He was a Taoist who planted trees on twin peaks. At that time, he inquired of the fourth ancestor we were just reading, Daoxin, saying, "Can you please explain the Dharma to me?" Apparently, he was the previous life of this fifth patriarch was already old when he posed this question to Daoxin. And Daoxin said, "You are already old. If I were to explain it to you, you couldn't use it to save beings, liberate beings. But if you come here again in your next life, I'll be waiting for you." The old man then left. Now here we go. Fasten your seatbelt. Walking to the bank of a river, he saw a young woman washing clothes. Bowing, he said, "May I pass the night in this place?" The young woman said, "I have a father and an elder brother. You can go ask them." The old man said, "You answer me, then I can be on my way." The young woman nodded her assent, and at this, the old man turned and left. The young woman was a daughter of the Zhao family, and later, after she returned home, she was found to be pregnant. Her father and brother were furious at this news and drove her out of the house. Sounds like modern-day Afghanistan or Pakistan. Drove her out of the house. She had no place to live, so during the day she made a living by making garments, and at night she would find a guest house to dwell in. Later, she gave birth to a son. And then it says she kind of tossed him aside because he was unlucky. And then changed her mind. She had a change of heart. She then undertook to raise the child. When he was a little older, he would follow his mother as she begged for food. Villagers called him no-name child. One day, the mother and son encountered a wise man. He said, "This child lacks only seven marks," and which the Andy Ferguson here helps us understand this. It means all he lacks is the seven distinguishing marks of a Buddha. According to Buddhist mythology, a Buddha has these distinguishing marks. I've always heard 32, the 32 marks of a Buddha. Here we have seven. And so he's basically saying, this guy's got the whole package. And then he says, this wise man says, only the Tathagata surpasses him. Later the child met great teacher Daoxin, and becoming his heir, taught people by expounding the Dharma at Mount Puto. And then in this same book, Zen's Chinese Heritage, we have just one entry for the teaching of this Hongren. And it's an endorsement of practicing in rural areas. A monk asks Zen Master Hongren, "Why can't the practice of Buddha Dharma take place in cities where there are many people instead of at places deep in the mountains?" Hongren answered, "The timbers needed to make a great building originally come from secluded mountain valleys. They can't be grown where many people are congregated. Since they are far from large numbers of people, they can't be chopped or harmed by axes and are able to grow into great building material, later to be used to make supporting girders and beams." Beautiful, another beautiful metaphor. "So in practicing Dharma, one should find refuge for the spirit in remote mountain valleys, escaping far from the troubles of the dusty world. People should nourish their nature in the deep mountains, staying away from the affairs of the world for a long time. When not always seeing common affairs, the mind will naturally become at ease. Practicing Zen in this way is like planting a tree with the result that it later can bear fruit." If this Hongren saw the cities of 7th century China as being full of the dusts and of common affairs, what would he say now, seeing how many distractions there are, so many things to divert our attention from the way, so many things, so many ways to avoid the great matter. During this era, the great teacher Hongren only sat peacefully in an upright position and did not compile writings. He only taught Zen principles by speaking about them, quietly passing on the teaching to other persons. Roshi Kapler used to emphasize the importance of hearing the teaching. He would quote the Buddha as saying, "Hear the truth, practice it, realize it." Not read the truth, but hear the truth. And then there were 10 disciples who inherited and passed on Hongren's teaching. One of them, of course, was the 6th patriarch, Hui Neng. The text quotes him to say, "Of the countless students I have taught, many have passed away. There are only 10 remaining who will transmit my teaching." Now back to our text from the Dunhuang Cave, Zen Dawn. The one who took it up after Chan Master Daoxian was Hongren. Hongren transmitted the Dharma, was an honored man of the subtle, wondrous Dharma. It says here he produced no written record. So there is a book in circulation on the Chan practice, said to be by the Chan master Hongren, but this is spurious. It says his father early on abandoned abandoned him, and he was burdened by the filial duty to support his mother. Well, not for long, it seems, because it says he started to serve Chan Master Dao Shin at the age of 7. That's back to our little boy who only lacked the 7 marks of a Buddha. After leaving home, he dwelt at Yuju Temple. He occupied himself with saving beings with ever-increasing compassion. The intent within him was noble and pure. He kept his mouth shut in the arena of affirmation and denial. In environments of form and void, his mind was fused. People worked to support him, and Dharma companions sat at his feet as disciples. Balancing his mind, he took as his task contemplation of the cosmos. The teacher was indeed illuminated in his contemplative perception. For Hongren, walking, standing, sitting, and lying down were all sights of enlightenment. Actions of body, mouth, and mind were all the business of the Buddhas. For him there was no duality between stillness and confusion, so speech and silence were ever one. During his time, people came from all quarters and all classes to ask for instruction and make him their teacher. They came to him empty and returned full. Thousands came month after month. During his lifetime, he bequeathed no written works, but his truth was in accord with the mystic message. These students of his came to him empty and returned full. Contrast that with the Zen master who said, I went to my teacher with empty hands, and with empty hands I returned. Different language, same point. Monks and nuns and lay people alike gathered around Hongren, working to provide support. He taught them the meaning of the Lankavatara Sutra, saying, only those who witness it with their minds fully know this sutra. It is not something that verbal analyses can explain. On the 16th day of the month, Hongren asked the assembly, do you know my mind now or not? A monk took it upon himself to answer, we do not know. The great teacher Hongren then indicated the 10 directions with his hand. Each and every one sets out the mind that is realized. At midday on the 16th, Hongren faced south and sat quietly. He closed his eyes and died. He was 74 years old. And then in this text, we have a eulogy from a certain man who, they say, is formerly minister of the Department of War. Boy, even back in the 6th century, they had the 7th century, a minister of the Department of War. But this is what the guy said about Hongren. What a marvel was the master. In mystic accord with the reality of the path, he gathered in his mind and cut off intellectual knowledge. With lofty enlightenment, he penetrated the spirit. Free of birth, he realized the fruit. Showing extinction, he shared the dusts. Here and now he has been transformed. How soon will anyone approach his level? And then it presents another teaching. Hongren also taught, when you are sitting, settle your face, arrange your body properly, and sit straight. Relax your body and mind. Through all of space, see as from afar a single word. Let's call that Mu. There is an inherent sequence. People of beginner's mentality do a lot of grasping at objects, grasping at Mu, and thoughts. You should contemplate a single word in your mind for now. After you experience realization, as you are sitting, as it will look like this. In the midst of a vast wilderness, far off, standing all alone, is a high mountain. You are sitting on open ground on top of the mountain, looking off into the distance in all directions. There are no boundaries. As you sit, you fill the world. He's describing samadhi. Relaxing and releasing body and mind, you abide in the Buddha realm. This pure body of reality, which is limitless, can also be described like this. Relax your body and mind. There's a difference between being relaxed and being lax. Being lax means a kind of limpness. But we can relax and still be taught in body and mind. In fact, we need to relax in order to work most effectively. If we're straining, if we're tense, then we're not going to be able to work as well. It's one of the many benefits of extended sitting is that we become more relaxed. We don't want to have to think about being relaxed. That's thinking. But it just happens by and by. When we sit long enough, we become more relaxed. We don't have to make a project out of it. It just happens. Of course, if we notice, when you notice that you're tensing up, then you can consciously relax. But relax with vigor, with tautness. Without slumping, either physically or mentally. Our time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. liberate. Endless blind passion, thy vow, Dharma gaze beyond measure, I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha, I vow to attain.